everyone, and welcome to PsychTech, the Psychology and Technology Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Josue Cardona, and with me, as always, Kelly Dunlap.
Hello. Hey.
All right. This week, finally, we get to talk to virtual reality. And we brought it up briefly a couple of weeks ago. And at that point, Kelly, you said you had not tried on any virtual reality, but that has changed. So we get to have a very different conversation this week.
Yes, I have been initiated into the Oculus cult.
Now, we also mentioned a few weeks ago that we were going to go to PAX East and we're going to go to a presentation. And I got extremely sick and I had a horrible fever, so I couldn't make it. And you got to go. So could you just, leaving the VR talk for a little later, could you just tell us how it went and if you had a good time, what happened there?
Well, PAX overall was fantastic, like it always is. It was PAX East, so it was in Boston, which had 100 inches of snow, so it was very cold. But within the convention center, as always, it's just a great time. Some of the things that I played some games on the show floor, which was really exciting because I typically am in panel queues all day and don't play a whole lot of games. But this year, I didn't go to so many panels. There was one that I was on that Josue was supposed to be on, but, you know, he bailed.
And... I did not bail. I almost died.
Okay. And so that went really well. That was with Dr. Patrick O'Connor and Dr. Sean Knuth, or Knuth, I think is how you pronounce it. And that went really well. And I did the interview that we're going to talk about later. Got to play some Halo, which made me really happy because it's always good to go back to my roots. And saw some really fantastic cosplay. And PAX is not really known for its cosplay, but there is some solid cosplay in the area. And it's an overall really great experience. Probably one of the coolest things is I got a Steam code for the Telltale Collection. So all 100 games.
What?
Yeah. I'm so excited. And, you know, it was PAX. We did a lot of stuff. We ate a lot of food. I got to go to some really cool parties. And, yeah.
Huh. Awesome. Yeah, I picked up the Telltale Collection a couple months ago when it was on sale on Live. Oh, I can't believe you got this thing for free. Oh.
I got three of them, but...
Really?
I already gave two of them away, so.
Oh, but it was on Steam, you said?
Yes, yeah, Steam.
Okay. No, that's awesome. I need achievements or trophies with my games, so I wouldn't do it on Steam. But good for you.
Well, thank you.
All right, so yeah, and I'm so disappointed that I missed PAX East. I loved it last year. It was so great. So great. Did you see any psychology stuff, by the way? Like, was there any other psychology stuff going on?
Yeah,
at PAX East?
Actually, there was. I can't believe I forgot to mention it. So huge shout out to our buddy Steve Kuniak.
Kuniak?
Yep. He had a panel, which was wonderful. And he also had a booth set up right by the entrance, and he was doing research there. And it was so cool. I spent actually a lot of time just lurking on the outside of the booth, talking with Steve and a couple of the other people working there. So that was really cool. I actually got to introduce him to the Operation Supply Drop guys. They're a charity organization that sends video games to soldiers overseas, as well as facilitates gaming and socialization and connection when they return home. So they're a really great charity. They were there. So I got those two to meet and cross-pollinate. And then there was also the AFK room, which is, for those who might not know, AFK means away from keyboard, and it's kind of shorthand slang for, well, in the computer world, for being away from your keyboard. But in this sense, it's a quiet, safe space for people to go to during the convention if they need to, you know, have some space to relax, some place to kind of collect themselves if they're feeling overwhelmed. It's staffed by mental health professionals as well as volunteers, and it's a really, really great space. So I went there and I talked with Mark, I believe is his name is.
Dr. Klein?
Yes.
Dr. Mark Klein?
Doctor, yeah. He scolded me for calling him doctor. So Mark, from one of the founders of Take This, which is the organization, the charity organization that sets up these AFK rooms. And so it was really great to see so much psychology present there. Although I do have to say that one thing that really irritated me last year, they were back. Yeah.
Okay.
And I left that in my strongly worded feedback to PAX East.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
And actually, I did a whole podcast episode where I covered that thing that we don't have to mention now again on Geek Therapy. I'll actually put that in the show notes because that like I went really in depth into my experience last year.
So just psychology part. Yeah. So just so you know what you would be checking out, there is a panel at PAX, which has almost become a regular, where people who have absolutely no mental health professional experience get up on stage and talk about how video games have helped them deal with their mental health issues, which is not a terrible idea until you realize there's no mental health professionals on the panel and they start making suggestions about medication. That's when I walked out last time, was when somebody started asking about her medication and the people on stage started trying to tell her what to do with her medication. And I was like, nope, ethical, not doing it. I gotta go. I can't sit here.
Yeah. Psychology is, you know, one thing, and mental health treatment is actually a completely different thing. You know, there are overlaps, but they are different topics. And yeah, just having kind of an open support group without any mental health professional there to kind of field questions and monitor the situation is very dangerous. Yeah.
Yeah, because if someone came up to me and said, Dr. Dunlap, I feel like my appendix is exploding, I would probably send them to the right kind of doctor.
But what if your appendix exploded? Wouldn't you just tell them what to do? Because that makes you an expert.
Right, right. And since I have no experience with exploding appendices, is that the actual plural for the body part appendix?
Don't ask an English major. I don't know.
Because I know it is for books, but you only have one appendix. I don't know if there's... Anyway, yeah, I wouldn't... You know, it's the same thing. Just because you... Well, even if I had my appendix removed, I would still tell them to go to a doctor. Just because we've had the same experience does not mean it's the same experience. Or that I am qualified to tell you what to do with your body.
Or, yeah, or diagnose or but remove their diagnosis at the, I mean, or remove their appendix at that moment. I mean,
yeah, just, but we digress. That's a topic. Yeah. That's a topic we're both very passionate about. And again, Josue covered it really well on Geek Therapy. So I'll let that sleeping dog lie because I want to move on to talk about cool VR stuff.
Yeah. And so let's see. I was really hoping that when we went there, you would at least have one virtual reality experience. And I tried to guarantee that by reaching out to the guys at Minority Media who were showing off a game there called Time Machine. And I wanted to see it so, so badly because these guys made Papo Yo. It was just this amazing, amazing PS3 game. I think it's on Steam now, too. And yeah, I'm pretty sure it's Steam and PS3. And it deals with alcoholism, but it's also like a beautiful game. It's not mechanically the best game in the world, but it was really fun, really deep. It was one of those games that felt like an experience. Mm-hmm. And so I've always been watching what they're doing. So when I heard they had a virtual reality game that they were demoing at PAX, I reached out to them. We got some time with them. So I think this is a good spot to kind of put that interview that you did with Ramel at Minority Media, and then we'll come back at the end and then talk about what happened.
All right, so we'll see you in a few.
All right, so I'm here with Ramel from Minority Media, and I know Minority from Papa and Yo, and going VR seems like a really big departure from Papa and Yo. Can you tell me a little bit about what that decision was or what was the thinking behind that?
VR it's something that we've always geeked about. I mean, Vander, our CEO and creative director, used to work in VR before he was in video games. He developed certain architecture prototypes with older VR technology back in the day, and he's always been fascinated by it. Our CTO, he's also been a very, you know, a big VR geek. And in general, I think as a company, you know, we've always, like, fantasized about the day that this kind of technology would become powerful enough for us to materialize some of the ideas that we've had in the back of our minds for a while. And so, you know, when the Oculus popped up, when Morpheus popped up, and we saw the kind of power that the technology had nowadays, you know, we saw a great opportunity to bring back some of those ideas that we've had in the back of our minds, and Time Machine is just the first one of them.
So you're talking about the power of the Oculus and the power of virtual reality. How are you guys harnessing that power?
That's a very broad question.
I can be more specific. What do you want out of using VR? How is that different than your traditional medium?
I guess, you know, in a way, I mean, you know, you were talking about Papo and Yo. VR to us, I guess it's probably the ultimate pathway towards empathy, you know, in the sense that, for example, with Time Machine, I mean, you're not playing a character that's separate from you. You are the main character in the story. You're in the middle of everything that's happening, and you're the main protagonist. As a result, you know, in the game, you're part of this team of scientists. You get to feel what it is like to overcome the challenges of a scientist from the future. And it's, you know, for us in that sense, it's kind of a continuum. You know, it hasn't really been a departure from what we've been doing before.
So after somebody plays Time Machine, what do you hope they walk away with as far as their experience, their empathic experience, their game experience?
I think what we're looking for right now is very well summarized by wow or oh my god. It's just a sense of, you know, Time Machine is a sci-fi adventure game.
Sorry.
And it's based on, you know, we've sourced it to what used to fascinate us when we were younger. Everything that was possible and impossible, time travel, dinosaurs, you know, everything that caters to that sense of amazement that films like Star Wars or 2001 Space Odyssey, or even nowadays Interstellar convey, you know, where you see these things and you're like, is this even possible? Like, can we actually achieve these things? And this is what we want people to walk away with, that sense of wonder, you know, that we tend to disconnect from when we play. I don't know why, but I feel that in a lot of games nowadays, there's a lot of cynicism, you know, there's a lot of, from the gaming community, there's a lot of cynicism, and this is us trying to disconnect from that and really just reconnecting with being kids again.
So, you know, we're from PsychTech, and we always talk about the intersection of psychology and technology, and the idea of games being used to build empathy is kind of a very emerging topic. So what would you say is, how is Time Machine doing that? How is it actually building empathy through advanced technology?
Well, you know, we started doing empathy games a lot earlier than some other developers, like, started doing it. And as a result, what we were trying to do back then is just challenge the rules of game making, you know? We've always been about challenging the rules. So challenging the rules of game design, challenging the rules of storytelling. And empathy was one way for us to challenge them, because nobody was making that kind of game back then. What we're trying to do, like, nowadays is not so linked to empathy as we used to do it 2 or 3 years ago. It's more of it's a different kind of challenge where, you know, we look at our team and, you know, they all came from a AAA background. They were making first-person shooters for years before they joined Minority. And, you know, Time Machine, in a way, kind of draws back to those roots, in the sense that it includes first-person shooter mechanics, but they're repurposed to the scientific uses of the story in the game. So, you know, we're taking first-person shooter mechanics and we're making them non-violent and constructive and enhance the adventure, the sense of adventure in the game. So it's not really about empathy for this game, but it's still about challenging rules, about challenging the rules of game design, taking, you know, we're grabbing this mechanic and we're turning it on its head and showing people that we can do something different with it, right?
So I am a student of psychology, I have my doctorate in psych. I also am currently in a game design course, so I am very, very interested in how, again, you're just kind of taking everything down, and you talked about some of the game mechanics that make it open world and make it explore-y, I guess. I'm going to make up that word now. So I guess, what's one of your favorite things about this particular title that really fosters that sense of wonder and creativity and exploration and non-cynicism?
It's the immersion. I guess the best word is presence. In conventional games, you're sitting on a couch, you're looking at a flat screen, and you're playing a character through that screen. So even if you're playing a first-person shooter, you're still looking at a screen, and then that screen is looking towards the environment, pretending to be that character. In VR, in Time Machine, you don't have that screen as an intermediate, right? It's you and the story and the game, and you're in the game. And, you know, just, I mean, the way I describe it sounds simple, but it's putting on the device and being in the game. You just don't expect to be experiencing all the sound and the sensations that you are, and it's really night and day when you compare that to a conventional game experience. It's really a lot of us at Minority talk about, you know, before VR and after VR, because we've been playing VR stuff so long now that afterwards when we go back to trying like conventional games, it doesn't feel the same anymore. You know, it really doesn't feel the same anymore.
How is it different?
I guess we feel a certain plasticity to it, a sense of it becomes a bit more challenging to connect to the game at that point. And I think as VR technology becomes more powerful, performs better, and you know, game developers become even better at creating experiences with VR, it'll become increasingly difficult to go back to conventional gaming and.
So what I'm hearing from you is that VR is the future of gaming at this point.
Totally, totally.
So not a doubt in your mind?
Not a doubt. I think VR will start with video games. It'll, you know, completely more video games, but I think it'll... Excuse me.
Sorry, man. Your welcome was, like, sticking to the background.
But I think it'll quickly spread to different kinds of media as well. I mean, we're already seeing it... a lot of experimentation with film. And I mean, you know, with the fact that Facebook purchased Oculus not so long ago, and the fact that Facebook seems to be going towards more of becoming a media company rather than a social media company, that kind of gives us clues as to where it might go in the future.
Well, speaking of the future, I just saw like a 3-year-old little boy just play, and I'm sure he could probably kick my butt at it because he's, you know, that's what he's going to grow up with. So, but I was really surprised to see somebody that young. I guess, what is your target audience for Time Machine?
Initially, we like to target what we call early adopters. So really hardcore gamers who, you know, feel comfortable investing in this kind of technology and really riding it out. They're also the audience that will allow us to really perfect the craft of making games for VR. So initially it's them. We're very happy so far because everywhere we've shown Time Machine, the response from hardcore gamers has been amazing. When we launched Papo and Yo, we got some resistance from the hardcore community because it didn't really match any of the expectations that they had about what a game is or what a game can be. 3 years down the road, you know, I think the gaming audience matured. They've come to know us as a company as well, a bit better. And, you know, when you put dinosaurs, time travel, and first-person shooter mechanics together, they just look at you and they're like, hell yeah, I want to try this thing right away. And we're very pleased that, I mean, we're hardcore gamers ourselves. So it's very cool that, you know, our own community looks towards us and says, yeah, like, we're looking forward to this game finally, you know, so it's pretty cool.
Yeah, yes, pretty much anybody on the show floor. Do you want time travel, dinosaurs, and a first-person shooter? And everybody's going to say, hell yes. When people think about Oculus, they tend to think only about the visual. But I know that you mentioned the sound, and people are wearing some pretty badass headsets. So can you talk a little bit about the audio involved?
The audio is, I guess the best way to describe it is surround. It's part of the immersion. We're still working on all the sounds and the music, which will be epic, really epic. I've heard, like, from what I've heard so far that we have, it's going to be amazing. And it'll play, I mean, sound is probably half of the game experience as well. I don't know what else to say about that, honestly. It's just, you know, it sounds cliche, but it's really taking it up a notch, everything, you know, graphically, sonically, and you know, everything else.
I feel like that would be part of the immersive experience, is having not only just sight, so you've got your eyes dealt with, you're getting your ears dealt with, you're getting feedback from the controller, because I'm guessing the rumble pack and things like that are on. So let's hear, that's 3 of the 5 senses. Are we, there's going to be taste and smell-o-vision at some point in Time Machine, please?
I don't know. I mean, at that point, I think, you know, I would need a time machine myself to figure out whether we're going to be able to implement that kind of stuff. But I mean, for now, it's really about, you know, targeting early adopters, the hardcore community. But eventually, you know, if we implement gadgets that are too difficult to get for a more mainstream audience, I fear that we might miss on that audience. And I think as you witness here, you know, with that kid playing, it will be something that would be really awesome for us to reach a more mainstream audience eventually with this game, because as a nonviolent experience, it's something that's cool for you to share with, you know, a kid, share with his dad, or you know, it's something. I mean, throughout this whole event, throughout PAX, we've seen families like approach us and actually enjoy testing the game together and talking about it, and like everybody's just having a blast, and it's really amazing.
So, because the Oculus is not widely dispersed, and I know this game is still, you know, kind of being built up and, like you said, expanded upon, how are you envisioning disseminating this game to people, especially when, like, again, the Oculus is not super available, the headsets you probably need to have the full experience are not probably super available or super accessible?
Yeah. For now, Oculus has only made the dev kits available mainly for developers, so it's not, the devices you see right now are not consumer devices. When it appears on the market, the device will probably be lighter, less bulky, probably nicer to look at, and better performing, definitely better performing. So, at the beginning, we're not anticipating like a large audience for this, but an audience that is willing to invest in quality game experiences for VR. But I think it's gonna, you know, with the Gear VR from Samsung already available, that's a mobile version of VR. I think they're aiming at a more mainstream audience. I think it'll become a device used widespread, like very widely used very quickly, kind of like cell phones were back in the 90s. You know, it just kind of took this leap. As soon as phones started shrinking and becoming better performing and multitasking, it just, you know, and VR is going to be the same thing. So, you know, I think shortly, within the next couple of years, it'll be a mainstream device. PC VR as much as mobile VR, so we're not worried about that at all.
So you guys really are like the game of the future, because you're making a game for an audience and a platform that doesn't really exist yet, or is just in its infancy, and you guys are really on kind of the cutting edge frontier of pushing games to the next level.
Yeah. If there's something we've learned with the previous generations of consoles, is that games that come out at around the same time that a console is launched on the market tend to become the flagships of that generation, you know? And we would like, ideally, we would like for Time Machine, you know, if we launch it at around the same time that the first consumer VR devices go on the market, we would be really happy if Time Machine became one of those games, you know, that people talk about for years afterwards as one of their first VR experiences, you know, that's something that's memorable.
So you want Time Machine to become the Halo or the GoldenEye of VR.
You read my mind.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. That was super helpful. I'm super excited to play it and share this with our audience back home. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
All right, Kelly. So when you finished that interview, you said right at the end you were going to go play the game. You hadn't played it yet. You had all these questions. How was it talking with Rommel? Was there anything insightful? I mean, anything interesting that from what he said? And how was the game? How was your first VR experience?
Okay, well, let me unpack that a bit. So Rommel was very passionate about the project and really drove home the importance that social impact games and emotional experiences have for Minority Media, the publishing company or the creative company. And you know, they really wanted to drive home and really take advantage of this new technology. And I feel like the most important part of that entire interview to me was when I asked him, and I told him, you're making a game for a console that doesn't really exist yet. You know, what are you hoping to get out of that? And he basically replied with, you know, they want to be the GoldenEye of VR. They want to be the Halo of VR. They want to be the Super Mario of VR. And that kind of shows the passion and the excitement that they have for the medium.
Yeah, and meaning by that, meaning that when the technology is finally available, that's your go-to game. That's the one that everybody's talking about. Like, you have to try this out.
Right. Yeah. And it's no experience on the VR or on any VR console would be complete without Time Machine is what they're hoping for. And after playing it, I am converted. I am convinced. I am on the VR bandwagon. Put me in. Send me to the future. I'm totally, totally down with it.
And how was it? How was the game?
Well, the first thing I wear glasses, and so to put on the headset, I had to take my glasses off. So that's kind of a step removed from immersion for me because I have to actually physically change. And of course, the headset itself is kind of bulky and kind of heavy, and it sits on the bridge of your nose.
Which headset were you using?
Oculus.
Okay.
And so again, just if no one's ever experienced it before, it's a very different sensation to have this giant thing covering your eyes, but you can still see. And then, of course, the headphones that have stereoscopic sound to let stuff ping back and forth and sound echoey. And then the controller in your hand. And it's, for me, it wasn't too bad because I don't ever look at my controller anyway when I play games because it's just so intuitive to me. But I know that there are other people who struggled. So when they were kind of talking me through the tutorial, they asked if I was used to playing games. And I told them I'm used to playing Halo. And he said, oh, you're fine. You're fine. So you know about strafing and dual toggle. I said, yes, I can manage those things. But I can imagine for somebody who isn't, that would also be maybe an impediment to becoming immersed in this world. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of go, one of the first experiences I have is I'm sitting there and they tell me to sit real still and then to turn my head left and right. And as I do, the world changes, which was really the first thing that kind of blew my mind because I knew that would happen, but actually seeing it happen was a completely different experience. And you start off in this, it looks like a giant airplane hangar. And so as you're looking around, it's just this big metallic thing. And out in front of you, you can see some landscape. But while we're still kind of calibrating, I have to look up at the ceiling and look down at the floor. And as I look down, I can see my hands. Not my physical human hands, but my virtual hands. And they're gripping onto what look kind of like joysticks. And I'm basically in a hover chair. So, which is really, really kind of interesting. And so it's just very basic tutorial of you have to get yourself out of this airplane hangar. So you learn how to, you know, float yourself up, float yourself down, move left, move right, basically learning all the mechanics that you need to survive in the world. And then I get out of the hangar and there's this gorgeous, absolutely amazing view. And of course it's 360 degrees because I can turn my head and see everything. And I believe it's of Sweden or Switzerland. But there's giant snow-capped mountains and lush green fields and this crystal blue river and the clouds in the sky. And the story behind it is that this is the year 2050 and all of the resources that used to go into creating war are now being channeled into creating science. So sign me up for that one. I'm absolutely down. And so I'm just exploring this world. This isn't even the game. This is just the intro to the game, and I'm just exploring, and Rommel, who's walking me through it, he's like, well, you know, go up. And so I elevate my chair, and as I get higher, I can get a better and better vantage point of everything around me, and it's amazing. And then Rommel says, look down. And so I look down, and my stomach plummets. my chest tightens up, and my entire body just kind of jolts. Now, I'm not afraid of heights by any means. I don't have an issue with it. But just looking down, and my brain believes I'm 400 feet in the air with nothing beneath me. I feel like that's the initial feeling of what it would be like to skydive. It was crazy.
And are you sitting down?
Yes.
Physically? Okay.
So I'm sitting down, and I still feel like I'm going to fall. I got over it pretty quick. But that was definitely an interesting experience. My heart fluttered. Every reaction you would have with a startle effect or with, hey, the floor just beneath you disappeared, it was there. But it was really cool. And so I zoom my little scooter down, and the next part is that you are being sent back in time to study dinosaurs. So you're the first person to go back in time, and you have to be careful because the dinosaurs are carnivorous, and they are going to try and eat you. And so you are equipped with a piece of technology where you slow down time. That allows you to get close enough to the dinosaur to scan it. And so I jump in my little time machine, and I get transported back to the same place, but, you know, several million years ago. And it's all underwater. So the creatures are probably about 6 feet long. They're kind of like crocodiles. And they're all kind of swimming around in circles. And I swim close, and I slow them down using my time slow down thingy, and I start to scan one, and I get the complete scan. I'm like, yay, I did it. I'm so excited. And then Rommel leans over and asks, do you want to see something bigger? And of course, yes. So he reboots and toggles the thingy and whatever, and suddenly I'm in a different place. And on my HUD pops up this outline of a 30-foot-long giant crocodile thingy. and I'm like kind of scooting along underwater, and I can hear in my headset the mission control talking about, all right, now be careful. There are two of these gigantosaurs in the water, and the water's kind of murky, and I'm looking around, and I can only see one of them. And so my pulse starts to get a little higher. I start to get a little bit nervous because there are two of them, and they have just said there are two of them, but I only see one. So I scoot really fast over to the big one. I hit my time slow down thing, and I start to scan him. I'm about halfway done scanning him when my HUD starts to light up in red. That's typically not a good sign in video games. Red HUD is bad HUD. And so I turn my head, I physically turn my head to the side, and there's this gaping maw of teeth just slamming down on top of me. And that's, yeah, I got eaten by a dinosaur.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yeah. And the mechanic wasn't in there yet. For example, the in as we would say in my game design class, the colliders have not been allowed to hit each other yet. So it just kind of passed through me. But then they both started attacking me and slamming me against rocks. So it was pretty good that the colliders weren't on, because they just kind of kept passing through me instead of actually dismembering me. And so, yeah, I got eaten by a dinosaur. First human being to be eaten by a dinosaur. I'll take it.
No, I do want to get your impression on one thing, because if you've ever watched the movie on, you know, like on your TV, and then you watch the same movie or you watched it before in a huge theater, maybe an IMAX screen, I mean, there's this different feeling when you see something big on the screen, mm-hmm. and you feel small. And then with the VR, I mean, you're actually, it's not just a window into that place that you're looking at, because, you know, as a screen, you're actually able to look around you, right? So one of them is to your left and the other one is in front of you. Like, how did that feel? How different was that from playing other video games? Like, Halo is full of huge stuff during the campaign. So, like, how was this?
I feel like, I don't want to say I felt like I was there, because I feel like that said a lot, and I don't think it's quite accurate. But it was much easier to have genuine reactions in that world, because it takes up my entire view space. That it my brain... Part of my brain, the old part of my brain, thinks I am actually there. The new part of my brain is saying, old brain, you're an idiot. We're on the show floor in Boston, not in the, you know, Mesozoic era. But it definitely is easy to not forget, but forget.
Yeah.
I think what would have been interesting would have been if I had been allowed to, because Ramel was there the entire time, kind of coaching me through, helping me with the controllers and figuring out what I'm supposed to do. I wonder what it would have been like if I could have played for maybe 10 minutes without any interruption. I wonder if maybe that's when I could have gotten that really, really immersive experience where it just kind of takes over everything. Because one, I've got him talking, so that's drawing me out of the game. Two, it's PAX, and so there's tons of people. That, you know, every now and then my seat would get jostled or the table would move. So there's all these different pieces of feedback that are reminding me, hey, you're still here.
So, could you still hear the show floor?
I probably could, but I was so focused on what was being said that I heard it, but I guess I didn't pay attention to it.
Okay.
But I could definitely see if I was left to my own devices. I don't want to say get lost, because, again, I feel like that has a negative connotation, but I could really go there.
Gotcha.
And... yeah, there's just something about taking up your entire field of vision. Like you said, the difference between an IMAX and your tablet screen. That's kind of what it was like between playing that game in that space and, say, coming home and playing Halo on my TV. It definitely has a different sense of scale, and I think it has that same potential to have as large an impact in that same way. That it's a completely different experience, and I, again, am totally on board with it. I want one.
Now, a lot of designers are making games in a traditional sense where you could play it on your TV, and then it also has a VR component to it so that you could play it with the headset on. And my understanding is that Time Machine is just a VR game, right?
That was my understanding as well.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting to see people, to see designers, you know, completely, they're all in.
Oh, yeah.
They're like, this is it. This is maybe not the only future, right? But this is definitely going to be a large part of gaming in the future.
And I think what was really fun for me is, one, here's Time Machine, which is this, again, incredibly immersive experience. And then I went and played another VR game, another Oculus game called Keep Talking and No One Explodes.
Yeah.
Which was a completely different experience. So what this game is that it requires two people. One person gets the headset and one person doesn't. So step one, I didn't get the headset. So automatically it's a different experience. But the person with the headset sees a bomb, and it has wires and triggers and buttons and all these different things. So they can see the bomb, and the other player can't. However, the other player has the instruction manual on how to defuse the bomb, but of course the person with the headset can't see it, and so you have to work together to disarm the bomb. And I do have to say that my husband and I, on our first attempt, we got, I think, the number 6 fastest score, the number 7th fastest score, to disarm the bomb, so... It was legit.
Had he played VR before?
Nope. That was his very first VR experience.
Okay. And what did he have to say about it? Like, I know it wasn't Time Machine. You know, it was a completely different experience. But what did he say?
Well, that's the thing about John you have to understand is, you know, you say something like, hey, it's sunny outside. And he will say, oh, that's nice. You could say, John, you just won $1 million. And he would say, oh, that's nice. Gotcha. So he said it was nice. And he enjoyed it. He had fun with it. But again, I think it took us 1 minute and 30 seconds to disarm the bomb, maybe less. So not a lot of time to play. But he really wanted to try it.
Yeah.
Like when we were in line, the line was capped almost right behind us, so we wouldn't get to play twice. And he's like, I really, you know, you got to play with the other VR game. Can I play this one? I was like, okay, that's fine. So he's also on board the VR bus.
Gotcha. Well, and then you got that experience of seeing somebody with that headset on. What was that like?
It's so weird. It really is just bizarre because you're standing there, and I got to see this at the Time Machine booth as well. There was actually a little 4-year-old or 5-year-old boy who was playing, and I'm going to tell you, it hurt my gamer pride a little bit because he beat the game. He didn't get eaten.
Really? I was going to ask you about the kid because you mentioned him in the interview.
Yeah, he didn't get eaten, and so afterwards... And I took the headset off. I looked at Ramel and said, that little boy just kicked my butt, didn't he? He said, yeah, but if it makes you feel better, we turned aggressive mode off so he couldn't get eaten.
Gotcha.
I was like, ah, okay. I feel redeemed. Yes.
So, I mean, there's always this funny thing, at least now, right, because it's still new, and you see people always kind of looking around, you know? Mm-hmm. They're looking up, they're looking down, because it's something that you can't do with your TV screen. And so how did the kid look when he was doing it? I mean, did you get to watch him at all playing?
Oh, yeah. I went full, you know, psychology nerd mode and observed.
Took your notepad out. And
just observed everybody playing it, both the bomb game and the Time Machine game. And it's interesting because at first, their head's just moving around. And you can see them just kind of checking out their surroundings. Mm-hmm. And it's so curious from the outside because I want to know what they see. I mean, a very, really fun basic psychology trick is if you start staring at something, people near you will start staring at it too, because it's human nature. If you're staring at something, it must be worth looking at, so other people will look at it too. And it looks a little bit, I guess alien would be the word I had for it, is here's a person and I can see all of them except their eyes. And it's a little bit disconcerting. It reminded me of the Borg. Just a tiny bit, because there's wires everywhere and you can't see their eyes. But the little boy took to it like a fish to water. And I noticed some other people who were playing had a little bit more trouble navigating the space, but that makes total sense. And yeah, just the manipulation of the controller, I think, was a tough thing for some people. But if you were a gamer, you really didn't have any problems with it.
What kind of controller were you using?
It was an Xbox...
360.
I think it was a 360 controller.
Yeah.
Okay. Not a one. And so, yeah, it was very natural in that way. But, yeah, a lot of people were interested. A lot of people wanted to play it. A little boy got a round of ovation, and I didn't. And it kind of smarted a little bit, but I moved on, obviously, because I'm talking about it now. And, oh, one of the really cool things, while I was waiting in line to play Keep Talking and Nobody Explodes, is that they had this screen, they had a TV monitor up so you could see what the person who had the bomb saw, mm-hmm. but the person with the instructions couldn't. So you're standing there watching, and, you know, the person with the instructions is asking, are there, you know, four wires? And the bomb person says, yes, there's four. But you see that there's one tucked under the corner, and so you know there's actually five. You're like, no, you're going to pick the wrong one. And it was, as funny as it was a very communal experience, because we're all watching this happen, and we all know something that they don't know. And that's really, really cool, and it's really interesting. And that's very esports-esque.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's also an example of the buzzword around that now is asynchronous play, right? Yes. Where there's multiple people playing and everybody sees, has a different experience. And not in the sense of, like using Halo again as an example, we can all be in the same arena. We can all be in the same map and kind of seeing different things. But asynchronous play is when someone has, one person has a completely different view of what's happening and even a completely different input method or even like power over the situation than anybody else has.
Yeah, two big games that are doing that, mainstream games, one is Evolve. So mm-hmm. for those who might not know Evolve, one person is a monster, four people are monster hunters. And so it's a five-person game, but it's 4v1, which is a really cool setup. And then there's also the new Fable game, where there are four heroes and one villain. Mm-hmm. And it's also set up in that, not asynchronous, asymmetrical. There we go. That's the word I'm looking for. Asymmetrical gameplay. So that's kind of like the new thing, but it definitely makes for an interesting experience to have that. It adds a level of challenge, I guess.
You mean the asynchronous nature of it?
Yes.
Yeah, my favorite, and the first time I had any experience with something like that was a game called Pac-Man Versus on the GameCube. Did you ever play that?
No.
So Pac-Man Versus, you would have, I love this game. I still have it. So what you do is you load up Pac-Man Versus and you require 3 Game Boy Advances with a GameCube link cable on each one. And they use one controller. And then the, oh no, no, I'm sorry. 3 GameCube controllers and 1 Game Boy Advance hooked up to the GameCube. And then the person on the Game Boy is Pac-Man, and on the screen you see a traditional, or you see the entire map, just like you would see on a classic Pac-Man game. And then the 3 people with the controllers play as the ghosts in a 3D version of the map on the TV. So the guy who's Pac-Man, or the person who's Pac-Man, can actually see the entire thing, see where all the ghosts are and move around, and then the other the ghosts actually have like an isometric view, so they can kind of see a little farther ahead, and they have to coordinate on the TV screen. They each have kind of their own first-person or third-person view, and then they're moving around, and then Pac-Man is kind of, you know, trying to evade them, and then if he gets the power pellet, he can actually take them all out. And it was amazing. I never played anything like that, and it wasn't until the Wii U came out that there were some games on the Nintendo Land compilation that are kind of like that, where someone on the gamepad can actually do something very different than what's happening on the TV screen.
I was just going to bring up the Wii U. One of my favorite games in that Nintendo Land pack is the Ghost game, mm-hmm. where there are 4 Mario characters and they're in a haunted house, and then there's a fifth player who's the ghost. And so you walk around this haunted house with your light or your flashlight, and you have to try and zap the ghost with your flashlight, but the ghost is of course invisible, and the only way you know the ghost is near is your controller starts to vibrate. And it's the same thing with the Mario chase one, where one player is running away and there's 4 players chasing them. And it's just a really fun new way of kind of doing stuff. But I had no idea it was on the GameCube. That's old school.
Yeah, well, and that's what I mean. Like, it's not a new concept. It's cool that it's coming back. And the bomb game is an example of that. But VR is completely new. You know, I mean, actually, let's take a step back. Let's visit the late 80s and the 90s for a second, where virtual reality was like in our movies, and Nintendo came out with a Virtual Boy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't the first time that we're talking about virtual reality. This is just the first time that it works, you know, and it works really, really well.
Yeah, Sega had a virtual reality device as well. I think they had 2 of them actually in the 80s and the 90s.
There was a lot of arcade stuff,
yeah.
You know, and in the home space, there wasn't, there was, there wasn't a lot going on. I mean, it was so expensive, and it just didn't work as well.
Yeah, it didn't. You know? It didn't work like it needed to, and it was too expensive. And I think that's possibly why we're seeing a second emergence of VR, is that the technology is at a place where it is affordable. I know I asked how much an Oculus dev kit was, and I think they said it was $300 or $400. Yeah. That's less than an Xbox One.
Yeah.
And so tech has gotten to the point where it's so cheap, you can make really highly sophisticated things like an Oculus for a market, for a consumer market.
Yeah, and the Samsung VR, I think it's $200 for the headset. And then if you already have a Samsung phone, the Galaxy 5S, I think, is the one that's compatible, then you just slip your phone in there and you've got your VR experience.
So there's the Samsung one. There's, as we talked about, the Oculus Rift, which is probably the most well-known. Sony has the Morpheus, which is their VR device. Mm-hmm. And the Vive, I think is what it's called.
The HTC Vive, yep.
Which,
the Valve and HTC Vive.
Which is interesting, and it separates itself from the others in that it comes with two paddles, one for each hand. So that way, when you move your hands in the VR space, you actually see your hands move. Because that's been one of the biggest drawbacks, quote-unquote, about the immersion of it, is that you move your hands in your physical space and you don't see it in the virtual space. But obviously with these paddles, that changes.
Well, and the Morpheus does that too, because it has move integration. So the controllers are like these joysticks with these big colored balls on them.
Kind of like the PlayStation Move.
Well, it is the PlayStation Move.
Rest in peace.
No, not rest in peace. It's the same exact thing.
It's the same exact device. They're trying to make it work.
So they said, Sony fanboy here, right? But they said that this has always been part of the plan. It was always part of that technology. They just released one part before. So it's all the same equipment that you would have bought 2 or 3 years ago as a Move. And it works now.
Okay, trust Sony.
Yeah. All right.
Xbox fangirl here. This is my doubt face.
Yeah.
But there's another one on the market that I just found this morning, actually, in researching for this episode. And it's called the Impression Pi. Impression.pi, as in 3.14159 Pi. Mm-hmm. And I want it. I want it more than anything else ever. It is both VR and, so virtual reality and augmented reality, so it can swap between the two. And the thing that excites me most about it is that it takes your physical space and converts it into the virtual space. So if I was wearing the Impression Pi, I could walk around my apartment, but my apartment would look like, maybe I could set it up to look like a dungeon for like a Skyrim quest. And so when I walk to a table, there would be a table in my VR screen. It would be decorated to look like some kind of ancient ruin table with stuff on it. But that way you could actually walk around in the physical space and not run into stuff, because the headset takes the physical environment and incorporates it into the virtual environment.
Yeah, there's one called the Sulan Cortex that does something similar. It's always scanning your environment, so it actually adjusts what you're seeing in your virtual world to a real confined space.
Mind blown.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's the point. I mean, you said to market, and I think a lot of people are working on these things, but really nothing has really come to market except the Samsung VR. It's the only one you can actually go to a store and buy right now. And a lot of companies are working on it because it is going to be... We're at the point where the technology works, so it's here, you know? People just need to bring it to market and actually have a commercially viable product. And that'll definitely happen next year, right? That's when they'll be in stores. And I think the reason why we haven't gotten it up to now is because, you know, last week we talked about sensors. And you wouldn't be able to scan the space and do all that stuff. Like we talked about on the HoloLens, you know, you need those sensors to be scanning. You need to be able to sense your movement so that it's one-to-one with what you're seeing on the screen, so that you don't feel like, oh, I have, you know, this clunky thing on my head. It feels like you're there. And that was really important, and we didn't have that before, at least not in a $300 to $400 product.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's what kind of begs the question, because we've talked a lot about the tech, but the psychology of it. What does virtual reality technology mean for mental health? I mean, we already kind of know that VR is being used in the VA, the Veterans Affairs, to help treat post-traumatic stress disorder through exposure and immersion therapy practices. It's being used to help train people to do different things in the military, especially, but in other places too. But I'm trying to think further down the line. I know the automatic first question that comes up from a lot of people is, well, you know, people are going to have saw their limbs off because all their muscles will atrophy because they'll never get up and move. They'll just sit there locked into their VR world. Or will this make us completely asocial? Will this isolate us? Will this bring us closer together? What does it mean for social interaction if we can have a virtual space like this? I mean, we already live in a virtual space. At least I'll claim my millennial generation does. I do a lot of living on virtual space, but to actually have that hardwired, or not hardwired, but rather added on to our physical body, I guess, is kind of the next step. And I've been trying so hard to think of what will virtual reality do for psychology, humanity, social relationships in 10 years.
So let's break this down a little bit.
There's
right?
a lot there, yeah.
So the experience, like the unique personal experience, I mean, it opens up a lot. There's a reason why Facebook bought Oculus, and I'm pretty sure that we will be able to, you know, there's going to be virtual tourism, and there's going to be things that you'll be able to do, and that you couldn't do otherwise, and you'll do it in an immersive way. There's this video, I just love this video, I'll put it in the show notes. It's about this woman who, I believe she was really sick, maybe cancer, and her granddaughter was a game designer. She brought home an Oculus Rift, and she had a game for her that she could go outside and walk in a garden, in this beautiful garden. It's something that she wasn't able to do anymore. She wasn't able to get up and walk around. And the woman explains how it felt to go up and down stairs, something that she hadn't been able to do in a long time, and to be able to see butterflies in this beautiful landscape that she'd never seen before. Like, she doesn't go outside anymore, you know? And to be able to actually, quote-unquote, walk on her own was wonderful for her, you know? So I think it's not too far to say that type of experience is therapeutic. There's also Google Maps actually has a Oculus, add-on to it. So if you have an Oculus at home, you can go into Google Maps and it has a setting for it. So then you can kind of, Google Maps isn't like perfect, but you can go ahead and look around as if you were in the map. And this woman did that, and she walked outside, something that she had not done in a long time. And she's walking outside, this crazy thing happened where she looked at her house, and apparently the day that the Google Maps car came by taking a photo was a few years before she got sick, and she was outside walking her dog. So she's actually in the picture. So the woman saw herself walking the dog when she was healthy through the Oculus on Google Maps. And she talked about how she was kind of like reliving that moment. It was a really powerful video to watch. And it kind of opens your mind to things that we don't really think about. Like, I can go outside and walk around, but what if I couldn't? And I think about like maybe going to places that I haven't been to, or, you know, if we reach Mars, can I walk around on Mars? Something that I don't think I can do, but what about something that I used to be able to do and I can't do anymore? Kind of, that's something very personal.
Yeah.
And, but then there's the social interaction part, which I think that's the part that's going to be really, really interesting. Because right now, you and your husband play video games, maybe on the same couch, you can look at each other. But if you're both in VR, you both have these headsets on your head and then you can't see each other. And then you're there, but you're all of a sudden so far, you know, very distant from each other, even though you're right next to each other. I that kind of thing is really interesting to think about, because what happens when we're all in a shared space, like, you know, Facebook VR or whatever happens, you know, let's say it completely changes to a virtual experience, kind of like a second life where everybody's actually there. And do we opt for that instead of actually going out and hanging out?
I think we already see that, at least that concern. I know a lot of parents that I talk with are very concerned that their child will be in a room with other people or in there with all of her friends, and they're all staring at their phones texting or surfing Facebook. And they ask, well, why aren't they socially interacting? They're in the same room, but they're all staring at their phones. You know, what's wrong with this picture? And I feel like it's important to know that there's nothing wrong with that picture. This is really the first generation coming up where we use technology, we rely on technology to socially interact with our surroundings. And I don't really see VR being that much different than how people use their phones right now, at least in that regard. Because I know my husband and I can be sitting on the same couch and we might both be on our phones. And again, it's older people who tend to worry about what that means for society. All it means for society is that there are new ways for people to interact and new ways for people to connect. And I think that's what VR is going to get to, too. And you mentioned virtual tourism, and that to me is really interesting. If, for example, would I want to virtually tour Australia rather than go there? I think I'd rather go there. I don't know.
But what if you couldn't?
Well, that's the other thing, is if I couldn't, then absolutely, that would be the next best thing. But as far as the concern that people won't ever leave their house or ever go out into the world because they're so sucked into their virtual world, I feel like that's the same worry rehashed since the beginning of time when Plato complained about the pencil. That there's always that fear of what's the next thing, what's it going to do to us, and I think it's important to just remember it's a tool, and it's a really exciting tool. And to me, the most important thing is to, if we're worried about the children, then we need to model the behavior we want them to use, not take away the stuff that they're going to need to be fully functioning adults in 20 years.
You mentioned the physical part of it, right? That concern that people's muscles are going to atrophy. We've already seen that people are working around that. And last week, you mentioned like playing a game like full body, Super Mario Brothers, where you're running around and jumping and things like that.
That'd be so cool.
Yeah. And last year at PAX East, I forgot the university, but they had this huge ball where you would run inside of it. So you could have full movement. There are gloves and things like that that people are working on designing. Again, the Morpheus uses move. You know, you're moving your arms around, you're actually using your hands to do things. There was a demo that they showed where you were actually trying to escape from this place. You were like tied up, and then you actually use the move controller to go and pick up a gun, and you're actually physically, you know, pointing and shooting like you would an actual weapon, not using just a controller. So, you know, that's full body movement, and you actually had to move around and duck to be able to get cover. And, you know, I think we'll see a lot of that slowly trickle in, you know? But if we're just replacing our video games or our computer time with VR time, then there's not going to be that much of a difference, you know? Because you still got to eat, you still got to move around, you still have to do something else.
I'm going to make the bold prediction that VR will actually increase physical health. Because when you think about VR, the more you are physically in the game, the more the game is realistic. So, for example, the difference between, say, me having a headset with Halo on it, sitting on my couch with a controller, and running through a Master Chief level, versus me having some kind of headset and being able to navigate a physical space and actually pick something up when I want to pick something up and do a barrel roll when I want to do a barrel roll, that creates such a more exciting experience. I mean, that's why paintball is so much fun. That's why, you know, actually physically going out and doing something, you can really get into it. So I think we might see the differences. If the games encourage physical interaction and reward physical interaction with a better experience, then we're going to see more physical interaction.
And what about, you know, how would it change gyms, right? It's like, for me, it's very boring to just be on a treadmill and not kind of watch the TV or something. But if I started a new routine where I'm going on this long walk through Australia, and I'm doing that on my treadmill, and the only way to advance is to actually walk through the space, then now it becomes very interesting and it becomes novel. And I'll probably engage more in that physical activity, purposeful physical activity, as in going to the gym, but now I get to do all this other stuff and I get to have new experiences. So I think it could change that a lot too.
Okay, Bing.
Yeah.
15 million credits throwback or 15,000 credits throwback.
Yes.
But yeah, so VR, my jury, I'm all two thumbs up.
So there's actually two things that are... So Second Life, there are actually therapists who have rebuilt their practices in Second Life. And then they have support groups and things like that, or even one-on-one sessions with people within Second Life. I always thought that was kind of one level too far removed, you know? But if you talk about it being a VR experience where you're both in a virtual space, but you're, again, you're actually there. You're more there than just looking at it through a computer screen. I think there's a lot of potential there to meet with a group. Again, it doesn't have to just be therapy. It could be any kind of meetup group. And now you can all meet up virtually. But virtually, again, the sense of being there and of immersion, and the buzzword now is presence, right, is very different. And I think that those kind of interactions will be great. And one thing that I actually think there's a lot of potential for is, so there's a book called Ready Player One. I'm pretty sure it's my favorite book ever. And in the book, we're at a point where, you know, the social network or the gaming, it's like if WoW just turned into a huge, just turned into everything, you know, just like replace the internet kind of thing. And everybody has a virtual headset, and that's how kids go to school. So they actually put on their headset, they put on their haptic feedback gloves, and then they log in, and then they go to school, and they're actually in a virtual school. And it doesn't matter where these kids are physically, they're able to go to school together, and they sit in a classroom, and there's a teacher there. And all of a sudden, it opens up access to education in a way that right now we're seeing with MOOCs and things like that. But to actually have a MOOC where you're present and you're there and there's a classroom where you can look around and you can raise your hand and there's a teacher looking at you, I think that's realistic. I think that that's awesome. And I think that people in places where maybe they don't have access to a good school or any school can now have a similar experience. And it doesn't feel as disconnected as just a live stream or a keyboard. We can actually semi-physically be there and go through the motions. I think that's fantastic. And I think that now that I've tried the technology, we can do that. Like, we could really, really do that.
Yeah, because I know I've taken classes online, and I know I don't do any work for them. But if I had to be accountable in some other way, like a VR classroom, I would like to think I would become more accountable. But yeah, the access is huge. I mean, imagine being able to just learn anything. That to me is the most exciting thing, is the ability to just pick something up and go someplace and learn through an experience rather than through a lecture.
So the last thing I'll mention is, last week I saw a video that caused quite a reaction in me. I think it's the closest to a Twitter rant I've ever had. And it was Samsung had this essentially a marketing video where they talked about how in Australia many families have to this experience, or one of them is working at the other side of the country, so they get to miss a lot of important family events. And this particular couple, the woman is pregnant, she's going to have the baby soon, and the way it's all timed, you know, they know the father is definitely going to miss the birth because he has to work and he has to be at the other side of the country. And that's just sad, you know, that people have to go through that. So Samsung's marketing team decides to set up a VR camera in the delivery room and set up a room for him wherever he is with a headset. And he's actually able to experience the birth of the child as if he was in the room with them using Samsung's VR technology. I have mixed feelings about it.
Why? Well, tell me about your feelings.
So one, like, it's sad that, you know, obviously people have to go through that. It pisses me off that, you know, Samsung spent so much money on doing that instead of like flying him over or keeping him around for a week. I don't know how possible that was, but they definitely spent a lot of money on this thing. And then what's weird about it is that he feels like he's there. He can look around, he can see what's happening, he can see it happening live. But I don't think he can actually move because the camera is stationary in the room. So he just has his one spot where he can stand and look around. And then no one else can see him because they just see this tower with this weird camera setup that is able to, you know, view every angle at once. And even if they could see him, they would just see this guy with a big, you know, helmet on his head, you know, looking around like an idiot. So I can imagine it was way better for him than not actually being there. But for the family, it must have been just kind of weird to just kind of hear his voice and only see like this weird camera setup in the corner.
The term that keeps coming to my mind is the next best thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to be an important part of understanding VR in the future, is that it is going to be the next best thing to actually being there. Because again, you could VR the Great Barrier Reef, or you could go snorkel it yourself. Mm-hmm. Now, if you can't go do it yourself for whatever reason, it is the next best thing. But I don't think that anybody would voluntarily choose the VR Great Barrier Reef over actually being able to go. That said, of course, school would be different. I would much rather do VR school than, but I actually would probably have to think about that a little bit. I think I might miss being around with my friends. So it's not reality. And I think the more people get used to it, the more they're going to realize that it is virtual reality and it is the next best thing.
Yeah. And in that particular case, there is technology like the Beam, which is like a camera with a screen on a Segway, essentially, that you can move around, that people can actually see your face. Like, I thought, like, for that particular situation, it wasn't necessarily the next best thing, because it was one of those things where, like, you probably want to see each other's faces while this is happening, you want to be able to move around the room and look at things, and that technology exists too, and it would have probably been cheaper than if setting up Samsung's thing. But we're at a point now where we have, actually, options for what the next best thing might be. And yeah, the interesting experiment will be, what will people choose? Will people rather do it, go there, or will people rather have the virtual experience?
I want both, please. I'll take both. I'll take two.
But next year, definitely, it's all coming. At least Sony says that they're coming out in 2016. And Oculus seems to be moving in that direction too. And we don't know how much these things will cost, but my guess is they'll be around $300. And VR is here. It's here. And there's games like Time Machine. I don't know, it's exciting. It's exciting. And it I'm is. So glad you got to try it out, because then we can, you know, it's hard to relate to that experience if you've never had it. I tried talking to a few people this weekend about it, and to them it still feels like 90s sci-fi. You know, even though they kind of see it on the news and stuff, because not everybody has tried it.
And yeah, it's still fringe.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely more pervasive than it's ever been. I think I mentioned once before, like almost pretty much any university with a tinkering budget, you know, has one.
I want VR now, please. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Let's do this. Why isn't Microsoft making a VR headset for that Xbox, huh?
Because they got HoloLens. That's all I mm-hmm. need.
Yep. Sure. All right, so I look forward to buying VR. I hope it's affordable, at least sort of affordable when it comes out.
It will be. They're not going to design for a platform that doesn't sell.
Yeah.
Sega learned that lesson.
Yeah. Oh, actually, the ViewMaster, the new ViewMaster is kind of set up the same way as the Gear VR. You kind of just slip your phone in there, and that has an application, and you can actually move around. It's actually a pretty simple version of VR, but you move your head around, and the sensors in the phone actually, you know, track your movement, and then you can use it as a cursor and look at one location, and all of a sudden you get transported to that location. The new ViewMaster is kind of cool, and I think that will be a good like stepping stone for people to kind of ease into VR.
I hope so. It's the future. Cool. It's coming. If you don't like it, too bad.
It's here. It's here.
It's
here.
Progressing.
Yeah. All right, so that's it for this week's PsychTech. I'm Oscar Cardona. My host is Kelly Dunlap. You can find us online at www.psychtechpodcast.com, on Twitter at PsychTechCast, and all of our past episodes are there. And we will see you next week. Keep that feedback coming. It's fantastic. Let us know what you're interested in hearing us talk about.
Yeah, shout out to our listener mail from Megan Whitney and Dario.
Oh, and Jamie Madigan, who on Twitter was telling us, talk more about video games. I hope we talked a lot about video games. So there's definitely going to be so much more video game talk. Yeah,
we need to talk about your achievement addiction.
Oh, yeah. Trophy addiction.
Sorry, your trophy addiction.
I got over my achievement addiction, and then it became a trophy addiction.
All right, well, that's the topic for another podcast. But thank you all for the listener mail. The front page on New and Noteworthy for Tech, you listeners are awesome, and thank you.
Bye.